Thank you very much. In matters for to save time, I'm going to control my urge to pose follow-up questions myself and rather leave the floor to our next speaker, Ms. Sigrun Mergedal. She will comment the report, and Sigrun is currently special advisor at the Norwegian Knowledge Center for Health Services. She is the former Norwegian HIV and AIDS ambassador. She's previously been a board member of the Global Fund for HIV, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, AGAVI, UNITAID, and has, as you heard, vast experience of aid towards health. She is also co-author of another Lancet Commission report, The Political Origins of Health Inequity, from 2014. And with that perspective, I think she will be able to comment the report perhaps a bit more from a policy and governance angle, which I think would add to the report's comment. Thank you very much, Sigrun.
Thank you, and thank you for the invitation, the fascinating presentation that we've heard. Just to say, I am not representing the government of Norway or any formal position. I'm just here to reflect from a policy and practice perspective. And since I'm an old lady, I haven't learned all the tricks of these tools, but it looks like it works. Let me just try to recap what I hear in terms of the formula. And my key word, I mean, these things you've just heard, and I don't need to comment on them, but it's a pretty selective scale-up that we're talking about, trying to see what may be the priorities, and if we invest in that, we will reach the grand convergence. It is not obvious that the countries that have moved forward on convergence have used that formula. So we need to keep that in mind. There are many ways to get there, and that may be the most important thing when one look at this report is to look at the basis for priority setting and seeing whose priorities and how can that be owned by those that have to make them in countries. So with this, I just think there is a focus on drugs and technologies, services to deliver them, but not as such services. This question of realignment, being proactive and respond, as we heard. So with that formula, the strength that I see very clearly is the economic argument, the case for priorities, the way that's stated, the focus on global public goods, the compelling vision in a way, because if we don't have a vision that we can get anywhere, we won't have that energy to move forward. And this is really presenting a vision that's doable, a focus on additional spending, and the case for progressive universalism. Those elements, I think, are really strengths of the report. When I match them with challenges, I note that political and social determinants are ignored and decide by decision because it was too messy and complex to bring them in, and we just heard that. So it's just a light touch on trade, taxes, multisectoral coherence, that kind of thing, which from other perspectives we know matters a lot whether you actually can do what you want to do and also create barriers. So it's not just a matter of finance, but it's also a matter of making money work, and some of those hindrances or opportunities are in that. I think it's a bit risky, as I just started with, to say that one can claim the keys for true priorities. And it's sort of a flaw in the report, I'm saying, to say, okay, these are the true priorities. Sweden, go ahead and make that argument to the world and to your partners that if you want to converge, we have decided an agenda for you and these are the true priorities. I think that there is a need for a lot more humbleness, knowing that setting priorities in healthcare in any country is a deep political issue that has a lot to do with understanding society and how political priorities are being established. So there must be political space for national decision-making and accountability in this. Although we heard a little bit around other things on global public goods, It's sort of the choices you've made narrow down on products and technologies, again giving the impression that you're sort of in the technology push. And there are a lot of people along with you on that. And then maybe it's definitely important, but risky to see it as the only clue. It's a quite an easy match with the 2015 vision. You have the vision, but when you look at the list of goals that we see in the 17 areas, pretty messy there, hard to see, but the vision is sort of different. So one has to figure out how to match those visions in order to be constructive in argument. I feel that there is very little focus on effectiveness of current spending. You're sort of hoping that it will be additional over and above, and that's the way you can spend it. But knowing that there is a lot of issues around how we spend money, Sweden has been strong in aid effectiveness, but the way we move now tend to invent a lot of separate tools, and we add to the burden of countries to have to get those things together. So again, it's not saying that this is wrong, but one sort of misses an understanding of bringing this together. And I also think there is a relative neglect of what one could call delivery science, the from the what to the how. And if I should look at Sweden, and you mentioned it, but the three bottom columns there under challenges is really where Sweden have been in its work. That's where Sweden has focused. So at least I would be really concerned if this argument would take Sweden away from that basic action. So I think also on the financing, and I'll come back to that, the financing instruments. But I think that there is more than an argument on aid volumes and moving from donor dependence to shared responsibility. And again, there is a lot of discussion what shared responsibility and differentiated responsibility means in this. Let's I shift my paper, but not my here. Okay. So putting this into the sustainable development imperatives, and we heard from the State Secretary the vision for seeing how this connects, and healthy people, healthy planet, healthy economy, understanding that the economy cannot any longer override environmental and social sustainability. I think that's one of the real big issues that we are facing in the sustainable development discussion. What is clear there, but it's not very clear when you look at what comes out of the negotiated texts from governments. But the concern was we need to have broader, more interconnected action on health, synergies across sector beyond health, and dealing with political, social, and economic determinants that maintain health inequity. I'm not sure that this is easily fit into what we talk about, but it's not a contradiction, but it's just saying that we need to watch. The sustainable development agenda is also a global agenda that goes beyond development assistance. This is where I had these common but differentiated responsibilities. And this concern of what is at the core of social sustainability or social cohesion, or what makes people work together. And it's not just money dropping in on them. There are a lot of examples and more focus on how one needs to build resilience from community and up. So even in the report that we have, there are some indications. If you look at the investment cases that you used as a basis for your report, each of them had some of those enablers in them, certainly with AIDS. It is very clear that without dealing with rights, without dealing with gender, without dealing with all the barriers, rule of law, trade issues, you cannot really get there. So in a sense, that's probably the biggest problem with your report, that for your analysis, you had to miss that out. The political determinants of health. Yes, there was an additional commission report, that were focused on global governance for health and made the political determinants of health the main case, and where the focus was on those transnational decisions or lack of decisions, because there are also gaps in decision that actually hinder health outside the domain of the health sector, how that can undermine health and maintain ill health and health inequity. So that's where we're right into the issue of power and choice. What matters is how much power, how is power distributed, how it's organized, how it's used, who make the choices, and what counts in making them. And that's, again, needs to be at the basis of national priority setting for health. So unless we bring priorities into that, we are going to fail. The fact that these policy domains that are affecting health are actually not recognizing them and responding to them is one of the key areas of that report, and points to institutional dysfunctions that allow these health inequities to persist, become deeper, more stubborn to deal with democratic deficit, the lack of inclusion, fragmented accountability, sticky institutions that are not really ready for change, that look after themselves rather than work with others. And in some of your global leadership suggestions, Sweden is going to come across that. And even within Swedish institutions, as with Norway, we have that stickiness even within our size. We're not very good at working across these sectors. So, again, if we then add into other players, not just governments, private sector, corporate sector, they have huge impacts. So I think that this is where we need to somehow figure out what we just heard from the State Secretary around effective political leadership and understand how Sweden can be a partner. Didn't I show you that political determinants? Sorry. That's part of my... Oh, dear. I was so focused on the watch here. The Swedish response, I'm not sure that classification makes such a huge difference. It's an interesting exercise, and I think that that's... But it's so many gray areas in the way that is set out that it's really hard. Now, one thing I'd like to mention was that Sweden was an early leader in global public goods. When I was a state secretary way back, my Swedish colleague was right in the front of talking about what is global public goods and how can we deal with it. So in a sense, here Sweden has quite something to build on, but it also turned out it was terribly hard both to define and deal with. But global leadership is much more than R&D investment in new technologies. And I think there are different ways of setting out these core functions or the global functions that one need to watch and look at. For Sweden, one shouldn't shy away from acting on political, social, and multisectoral determinants and rights. Because Sweden has been doing it, it's been standing for it, and we heard a little bit about it. And what you shouldn't lose in any shift is start relying on your money and not getting into the politics of how to deal with these issues. You've been able to engage in institutional reform of the UN system. You're a trusted partner with very many countries. You can build South leadership, you can facilitate, and maybe you should make sure that you don't only rely on having prime ministers and high-profile people leading, because the more you're on top, the less you're able to be facilitating and strategic underneath. And I think there is a trade-off there that one has to be very careful about so one doesn't lose those qualities. I think also you have a basis for making UHC a unifying force, and you were just told that also from the previous. The kind of investment tools we use, spending strategically, investment framework. I'm not sure that we are on the same bandwagon. I think we have to be very, very careful. Even with the new global facility, we have a number of these facilities. I happen to work on health workforce issues. None of these facilities are at all focusing on dealing with health workforce, so that's sort of systematically neglected. And it's really hard to make them function together for countries that receive. So there is a need for a lot more mutual accountability and ways to make this. So I don't feel that you have that investment framework that you can present, but you have one yet another piece, which is also good. My final comment, and I think I started a few minutes late, so I'll just take my last little challenge here, which I call the Ebola test. Because it was interesting to look at. You know, if we had done what we just have heard, would it have made us more prepared for Ebola? And would it somehow lead us into a more effective response post-Ebola? If we look at this domestic mix with development assistance, how would it have contributed to the primary care services that this universal progressive universalism is thinking about? In what way would it have contributed to having health workers on the ground, equity measures? Were we concerned about it before? How did targeted health initiatives that they've had in these countries, how did that contribute to access to these type of services with health workers on the ground? In what ways did the multilateral system engage in assisting preparedness and contributing to it? How would the convergence agenda as such have contributed to preparedness if we use the same channels and tools that haven't really done it? And in what ways were national institutions meant to identify and act on early warning? Now, post-Ebola, what changes? On what ways do we now look at priority setting? You argue for the diagonal approach, where you start with targeted interventions and you build systems as you go. I don't think many health systems in practice have actually achieved that, because health systems need to deliver what people want. They need to win in elections. They need to understand. They need to have trust. So what can that do? And do we need some sort of a horizontal capacity to make sure that these bits and pieces fit better? And how can WHO and other multilateral and bilateral partners better support responses to the international health regulations and so on? A huge challenge, and these kind of things were also out of that report. So my question is, in what ways can a convergence agenda that ensure critical capacity in surveillance also be built, and the multi-sector institutional response to preparedness? So going back to the way I started, great with a convergence agenda. I'm not sure that your prescription has all the elements, and we'll need to complement that with others. We'll need to put in the political action. But also one has to think about the sustainable convergence. And I think that's where the bridge, together with the debates in the sustainable development agenda, is a major challenge. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sigrun. That was a very comment that contributed to the earlier presentation that we had. Now I'd like to welcome up to the stage an additional speaker, Pia Schneider, who is an economist and lead evaluator at the Independent Evaluation Group of the World Bank. And we've invited Pia because the EBA report discusses where to draw the line between low and middle income countries. And that is used, of course, as a means for selecting where to allocate aid. And one of the things that the group that Pierre is working in is to look a bit more in detail what works when it comes to financing health systems in low versus middle income countries, and perhaps a bit more in practical terms, what can be done in order to ensure universal health coverage. So, Pia, welcome to the stage.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much to Mats and Sonia and the IBA team to invite me for coming to Stockholm and present this evaluation. It's really a pleasure to be here and also meet some former colleagues with whom I have been dancing a disco in Barcelona, as I just was told 10 years ago. Anyway, my name is Pia Schneider and I work for the Independent Evaluation Group, which is a department at the World Bank that responds directly to the executive directors and not to the president. And we evaluate the development effectiveness of the World Bank. And I'm leading the social sector team, which includes health, education, social protection and labor. We just did last or 2 years ago an evaluation on bank group support to youth employment. Currently, we have another one ongoing on early childhood development. And there is one coming on tertiary education. About 7 years ago, the bank did quite a spectacular, or the independent evaluation group did quite a spectacular evaluation on bank group support to health, which had a strong focus on health system, road safety, water and sanitation. And it found that the bank did not have a strong poverty focus. So it was quite a wake-up call, actually, for the Africa region at that time. And but this evaluation did not, that health evaluation, did not look into bank group support to health financing. And so about 2 years ago, when we started this evaluation, the IEG, the Independent Evaluation Group, was asked to do an evaluation on bank group support to health system, because that was such a, or still is, a sexy term at that time. And we actually started out with writing a concept note for an evaluation on health system. And then we found that there are about 31 definitions of health systems out there, and it includes health service delivery, which already has been evaluated, and we did not want to repeat this. So we came to the conclusion that we want to focus on something very concrete and where the bank is supposed to be have a comparative advantage according to its strategy, and that's health financing. And I'm going to present now a couple of findings from this evaluation, and as well as recommendations. You can download the full report from the IEG webpage by just simply going to ieg.worldbank.org and look for health financing evaluation. First, an overview. These are the Himalayans. actually, if we look at overall development assistance for health, and that picture is actually from the University of Seattle from Washington. They come out every year with Global Development Assistance for Health. We see that the total amount that has been going to health has gone up tremendously over the past 20 years. And as you see, it has gone up from about 10 billion or almost 10 billion to more than 30 billion in the past 20 years. However, within that, and I'm not quite sure if this is a pointer, so let's see. No, it's not. Okay. So the blue and red is World Bank, and that includes IDA and IBRD. IDA is the lending that goes to very poor countries, the low-income countries, and IBRD is the lending that goes to countries that actually can pay an interest rate. So the not-so-poor countries, they pay an interest rate of about 1 or 2%. What you see is that the amount that went to these countries from the bank has remained on a similar level, but because global funding went up so much, the share that came from the bank has gone down from 6 to about from 20 to about 6%. Now, this other includes all the bilateral and the global programs, and the big chunk, and it's detailed on the University of Washington from Seattle webpage, a big chunk of this is actually vertical funding to AIDS programs like PEPFAR, the Global Fund, Gavi, and so on. Okay, so overall funding has gone up tremendously, and the bank has remained on a similar level. Now, this includes all health, okay, not just health financing. Now, when we looked into health financing, we couldn't quantify how much the bank actually spends on health financing, just simply how the loans are organized. Very often the bank disburses a large amount to the government budget based on the condition that certain policy actions are being passed. So you can't really quantify how much that would have, you know, been in dollar terms. So, but we could count the number of operations that supported some health financing actions. And we found that in the past 10 years, the bank has approved about 188 bank operations in 68 countries. Of these, 35 were in 20 fragile states. Now, contrary to you, you have a certain selection in CEDA on how selection criteria on how you select your countries, but the bank responds to the demands of the Ministry of Finance. So the countries come to the bank and say, we would like to have a loan, and that should include a health financing program. So we don't necessarily have a specific selection criteria. Now, what are these projects financing? We used the system of health accounts framework and the health financing framework from the WHO, which was spearheaded by Joe Kutzin's team, to organize these health financing interventions that were supported by the bank into four groups. And what we see is that the most of bank support went to revenue collection from public sources. However, this support has decreased over time. So this is over there, the first one, the big one. This has decreased over time, and there was a substantial increase to purchasing. And support to revenue from private sources, which would include out-of-pocket payment, and risk pooling has remained on a similar level. Okay, but most went to revenue from public sources. So what does this include? What kind of activities? In revenue for public sources, this includes the level of the health budget, subsidies, tobacco taxes, payroll taxes. Then in revenue for private sources, it's the level of user fees paid by patients. So that's the same like out-of-pocket payments. Risk pooling, we have fiscal targeting, expenditure management, and information collection in either social health insurance or in national health systems. And in purchasing, this mainly includes paying healthcare providers, the different payment methods for healthcare providers. So what we did is we took this entire bank portfolio and coded it against these activities. And then we asked the questions, if we have these three or four main intervention categories of revenue collection for health, risk and fund pooling and purchasing, what is the effectiveness of bank support to these intervention with regards to improving equity in service use and financing, financial protection and efficiency, and what were the success factors for successful bank support? Okay, so these outcomes, equity in service use and financing, financial protection and efficiency, are explicit outcomes that the bank aims to achieve in its health sector strategy, which was approved by the board in 2009. So it's more or less an objective-based evaluation. So we reviewed the entire portfolio to come to the conclusion on that. So the way we did this now is we had project data from 188 projects. We did 16 country case studies where we did an in-depth analysis of these of specific questions on this. We also reviewed impact evaluations. The bank has written about 14 impact evaluations of projects where this kind of support was done. We had also project assessment reports from the IG. We do specific project assessments. And we had interviews with 25 international health experts. We also did a survey with bank staff and managers. And we reviewed World Bank analytics, which included about 20 poverty assessments that were done in different countries and 100 public expenditure reviews and economic sector work that was done by the bank on health financing. So I will just share 6 key findings with you, which I think could also be relevant to see this work. And but if you would like to see more, then you should go to the webpage. First, bank support to revenue collection from public sources has helped raise or to protect public revenues for health. And there was limited support to tobacco taxes, mainly in middle-income countries. And one example that really stands out, and I think where the bank was most successful, was in the Philippines, where the Philippine government has introduced a tobacco tax. And now at the annual meetings, we just had the presentation by the deputy minister who said that they did a household survey and could already show that smoking went down among the lowest income group from about 30 to 18%. They have raised substantial revenues for health, and it's earmarked to the health budget or to health spending. And about 20% of the revenues that come from these tobacco taxes are being paid back to the tobacco farmers for foregone revenues from selling tobacco. So it has actually worked in the Philippines. In other countries, it has been less successful because either the tobacco tax that has been introduced was not high enough, or it has not been introduced. It stayed at the level of report writing. Second, what we also found is that very often, a bank loan lasts between 3 and 5 years. So the government may have increased spending or the budget for health, but government commitment beyond the bank loan was not necessarily there. So after the bank loan has closed, spending to health would go down again because the Ministry of Finance have competing needs. It's not just the Ministry of Health that comes and asks for more money. Education wants more money too, and other ministries as well. So it's always a balancing. So sustaining increased allocation to health is a problem that needs to be given more attention. Second, bank support to risk pooling has helped increasing the number of people who are covered in risk pools, and equity in pooling increased too. And this support has mainly been implemented in middle-income countries. So what has happened is that in some middle-income countries where social health insurance is financed from payroll taxes, the bank has helped improving the revenue collection or the payroll tax collection effectiveness from the formal sectors. And that has improved the financial sustainability of the social health insurance fund, as well as the number of people who are actually covered through social health insurance. Second, it has also helped improve equity in pooling, where the bank has helped governments to subsidize the enrollment of the informal sector workers who are not in the formal sectors and do not pay payroll taxes. And this, like, for example, that has worked through Ministry of Finance financing the contribution of informal workers based on some local formula so that they would be insured through the social health insurance fund. In countries where there is no social health insurance fund, like in Mexico or in Argentina, the Plan Hacer program, the bank has helped governments financing national programs for health, and increasing the budget allocation and the budget transfer to those health programs. Now, third, we have more money and we have more people in the pool. So what happens, right? What we found is that there are governance obstacles to actually making sure that this money is being spent pro-poor. And we found that good governance systems influence the implementation of health sector budgets and coverage. In many countries, governments just don't, or the government budgets are not implemented, or they are weakly implemented, or spending is not proper, and this is for several reasons. Like, for example, you have countries with weak management capacities at the ministries of health, and they substantially underspend the budget. So you have budget implementation rates of 70% in Tajikistan, in Afghanistan, in low-income countries, where it really would be needed, since they already allocate so little to the budget, that they would implement the budget 100%. But the budget implementation rate in many countries is extremely low, just simply because there is weak capacity in budget planning and in implementation. Second, and that's linked to this, there is weak technical capacity in the Ministry of Health, in the governments, and in health insurance funds. And that's generally the case, that the Ministry of Health are the weakest ministries in low-income countries, and therefore perhaps are also not that strongly positioned to the Ministry of Finance compared to the other ministries. And I do think that more could be done in building this technical capacity in financial management and planning in ministries of health. Third, there is a problem about information. Often there is insufficient information about the benefits, as well as who is actually a beneficiary of these programs, of the health programs, and of the financing. So just increasing the risk pool does not mean that actually people know that they are a member of the risk pool, and therefore they don't necessarily go and seek care. There are countries that have targeted national programs, but there are huge leakages in targeting. We just did an evaluation of Tunisia, and Tunisia has a national health program for low-income group, and they have a targeting efficiency of effectiveness of about 40%. Which means that about 60% of the money that is targeted or was targeted to that to the low-income groups through that program is not reaching the low-income groups. And then we have some risk pools that have tied up their finances in capital investment and do not have the liquidity to actually reimburse providers for the bills that they receive. For example, Tanzania, as well as the Philippines, Social Health Insurance Fund have a large percentage of their finances actually invested in capital investment, and that influences whether how liquid they are. Fourth, I don't think I have to show you this, but you know that worldwide, if we look at the revenues from to health, in low-income countries, about 60% of revenues for health come from user fees. And this is a huge barrier in accessing healthcare for low-income groups and the poor, because they simply cannot afford paying those user fees. But the bank has given limited attention to these user fees. Only about 15% of the health financing projects have actually tackled user fees. These projects gave, there is limited evidence from these projects that actually the financial protection and utilization has improved. There was no analysis about the fiscal implications for the governments if you abolish user fees. How much, what would that mean for the for the government to increase the budget? Because, you know, if the provider doesn't get user fees anymore, they need to get revenue from another source. But the fiscal, which ideally would be the government, but there was no analysis done on, you know, how much money would now the government have to spend just, you know, to compensate for the foregone revenue from user fees, but also to respond to the increased demand that results from a price decrease. And fourth, we also found that there was insufficient preparation of providers to respond to an increased demand when you actually decrease the price. So it has not necessarily led to improved utilization, because there were waiting lines and providers were not adequately prepared to respond to that demand. Fifth, purchasing. The bank has had in middle-income countries, very much a focus on helping social health insurance moving to DRGs, which is a provider payment from insurance to hospitals. And in outpatient care, they moved from input-based budgeting, or helped governments move from input-based budgeting to capitation payment, which is more or less transferring an amount to a per capita amount to the hospitals. In low-income countries, there has been a different story. In low-income countries, there has been a trend towards moving fee-for-service, and that's exactly from where the bank is moving away in middle-income countries. So there is a little bit, I would say, a different direction here. The problems are also different, so to some extent this can be explained to that. Now, this paying providers by the number of services was very much driven by the results-based financing program that the bank is currently implementing, which is funded by several donors. And it has led, among other things, to improved data collection on service delivery, because if you pay based on the number of services, you need to have then data on what services have been delivered. And it has also led to an improved service use, increased service use in these countries. Now, there are some concerns that we identified for this. There are still demand-side barriers, and there wasn't really any household survey analysis done that showed that who benefited from this increased service use, including the impact evaluations that were done by the bank did not provide a socioeconomic breakdown of the results analysis to show that the poor actually benefited. Now, there are now lots of impact evaluations going on, and they said they will be looking into this. Lots of this money, of this results-based financing, has actually been used to pay salary top-ups for health workers. This is up to 70% in some countries. Now, this has had quite some concern, has raised concerns about the financial sustainability of these programs and about spillover effects of other sectors, because you have in countries now, all of a sudden, the medical doctors and nurses making much more money than the teachers and the police and so on. And it has created, in some countries, concerns among the Ministry of Finance about increased demand by public sector workers for salary increases in other sectors. So this has not been taken into account sufficiently by the bank, this spillover effects on other sectors. It also has created high administrative costs because of the additional data collection that needs to be done and the verification of this data. To some extent, this is to be expected. As countries progress, they need better data and need to invest into that. And it needs to be supported by institutional reforms, and they did not necessarily happen in all countries, institutional reforms that support providers in responding to the financial incentive set through the payment. So if the goal is through the payment to improve the financial the efficiency of a healthcare provider, then the provider also should have the autonomy, the management autonomy and the financial autonomy to actually react to these incentives, and that has not necessarily been implemented. Sixth, in some country utilization has increased tremendously, but in some countries, it has not, despite increased pooling and increased budget allocation and attention to purchasing. There was really substantial improvement in some countries, like Turkey, Rwanda, Colombia are some countries which have made tremendous progress. But then in some cases, it did not. And the reason why utilization has not improved is because patients were not informed about the benefits that were covered, or the benefit package was limited. It covered services. It did not cover services that are relevant for the poor, like pharmaceuticals, which are relevant for the poor. Despite the fact that user fees were abolished, or risk pooling was increased, there were still affordability problems because there were under-the-table payment or co-payment was not sufficiently reduced. And service provision, the quality of care, is still a big issue. Even so, the financial, side has been addressed. The service provision side was not necessarily sufficiently addressed to respond to patients. So some success factors in successful bank group support. Government commitment, let me start by that, was definitely a success factor. If the bank managed to work within the political agenda of the government and mobilize the government commitment to these reforms and put the government in the driver's seat, then the bank support was much more successful. Integrating health financing with the broader public finance context was also a success factor. Let me just give you one example. In one country, the bank was actually in Central Asia, not Tajikistan, where the bank has helped government introduce provider autonomy, including that providers could retain the revenues that they collected from user fees at the hospital and the health facility level. And then another bank team came in and centralized the collection of all revenues collected in the public sector at the treasury. So the bank teams were actually working in different directions. So where the bank teams worked together and integrated health financing in the broader public sector context, that was more successful. Monitoring and evaluation is extremely poor in health projects. About 25% of health projects only have a satisfactory monitoring and evaluation rating at the bank. So if the bank were to do better tracking of what they actually did, we could eventually also find more successful work. And the analytical work of the bank is very difficult to track down. So it's not necessarily available. Collaboration is a big factor of successful bank support, where the bank has collaborated across sectors with the public sector team, as well as with other agencies that had comparative advantages that were important to the bank. Bank support was much more successful. There were some challenges to the evaluation that I want to identify. It's mainly related to the data. Insufficient data about the knowledge work that was being done by the bank, insufficient data on breakdown by socioeconomic groups. The bank still has a tendency to report average instead of broken down by socioeconomic group, which is particularly important now since the goal is to reduce poverty and promote inclusive growth. So we need to have a look at breakdown by socioeconomic group and poor project results framework. Two main recommendations. One is integrate health financing with broader public finance contexts, and we recommend that the bank continue to work on efficient and equitable revenue instruments for health, tax and non-tax, in countries, depending on the country context. Then second, and that goes to the good governance issue, that the bank helps countries on revenue and expenditure management to ensure that the revenues actually positively affect the provision of care and are spent pro poor. And that the bank also supports governments in broader institutional reforms to support the sustainability of health financing actions in the health sector. And second, the report recommends that the bank steps up its support to government commitment and build capacity to inform health financing priorities on a country level. And that can be done, for example, through helping governments introducing standardized monitoring of health expenditures in countries so that the Ministry of Health can actually also track where the money is going, which is kind of important if you want to negotiate with the Ministry of Finance at the end of the year for a budget increase, so that you actually have some data to show what you're doing. And that can be done through national health accounts, or is already being done through national health accounts. Benefit, and by the way, I want to add here that CEDA has in the past, I'm sure also still now, been instrumental in setting up national health accounts in several countries, including Zambia, comes to mind. Benefit incidence analysis, which actually shows you whether the money is being spent pro poor or not. Analysis of targeting effectiveness, where programs are supposed to be targeted to the poor. And fiscal and equity analysis of any changes that relate to financing in a country. To show what are the fiscal projections for that. To sum it up, four main messages. First, the bank support has helped raise or protect public revenues for health and increase pooling. Second, this support did not always lead to pro-poor spending. So just increasing the amount we spend is not good enough. It also did not necessarily lead to improved utilization and financial protection. Third, purchasing reforms are likely not sustained unless they are embedded in overall health financing and the broader public finance context. And fourth, there needs to be collaboration to draw from comparative advantages across sector teams within the bank, but also with other agencies, to establish institutions in governments and to support capacity building. Okay, so if you want more, as I said, go to the IG webpage. Now,
thank you very much.